Next, James Fleming edits the week's news on Voices and Events.
Monday was payday in Korea.
10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 95, 96, 97.
And 90. Saturday was Grand National Day in Liverpool.
Nickel coin over in front, and there goes Bloomfield, and now there are two. This is history. This is sensational.
And Monday through Saturday, men talked of presidential politics.
The job is really an impossible job. Any man who wants to be president of the United States ought to have his head examined.
This is Voices and Events, the program that covers the world to bring the actual voices and sounds in the news. General MacArthur and the president, college students and the draft, Winston Churchill and Prime Minister Attlee, Quentin Reynolds and politics, the sound and fury of this week's living history, presented through new techniques of reporting and recording. And now the editor of Voices and Events, James Fleming.
This week's world was a world of divided opinion, divided counsel. The new foreign minister of Great Britain, Herbert Morrison, considered the task facing him and noted that we all had our little ways.
All nations have their little ways. As a former mayor of New York said to me, Mr. Jimmy Walker, who I met by surprise at a certain gathering one night, and having told him about the purity of the London County Council and its utter incorruptibility, of which he certainly didn't believe a word. though it was true, but he said in an after speech following mine, he said, "Well, Mr. Morrison, I'm very glad to hear about this London County Council and how upright and how honorable and straightforward it is and that you can't do anything wrong." He said, "I come from a little old city called New York, and there's millions of this race, and there's millions of the other race, and there's millions of the third, fourth, fifth race." And he said, "Mr. Morrison, believe me or not, they've all got their little ways." And he added, I said, "I had to have my little ways too," and he certainly did. So we've got our little ways. All nations have got their characteristics.
And in Tokyo and Korea, General MacArthur proved again that he has his little ways. And once more, his words on matter of policy were berated in London, rebuffed by the administration, and applauded with enthusiasm by the general's Republican supporters. As he returned to Japan, MacArthur spoke for himself.
Here comes the general now.
General, you got anything to add to the statement that you put out on Korea?
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
My trip was merely routine, has no such special significance. I try to get over, inspect the front, whenever my other duties will permit.
Thank you, General. Thank you, General.
Thank you very much, General.
In a letter to Representative Joe Martin of Massachusetts, General MacArthur agreed that Chiang Kai-shek's forces should open a second front on the Chinese mainland. This appears to be a direct violation of orders given MacArthur by the Joint Chiefs, orders to refrain from controversial public statements. And in Korea, we've met stiff opposition across the parallel. But over there, it isn't all fighting. At 8th Army Headquarters, Warrant Officer Robert Bergman leads the band in Ruffles and Flourishes. And then he tells us about a general's favorite song.
General Ridgway, upon his arrival at this headquarters, was more or less greeted by the band. And we stood out in front of his headquarters and played for him a few minutes. The first number we got up was the All-American Soldier, which I believe is General Ridgway's favorite song, perhaps because of the memories it brings back of his old command during the last war. We'd hardly completed the introduction of the number when General Ridgway was out of his office and standing in front of the band, and I believe enjoying it a great deal.
The 8th Army Band in Korea, and this is that song. The All-American Soldier. In this 10th month of the war in Korea, another 1,100 of them joined the lengthening casualty list. Life in this far-off country brought glory to some, rest and relaxation for others, and now and then, a welcome payday.
Running a little over $91,000 payroll today. Oh, about 883 men will be paid. We got one little boy here we're waiting for. He's got $925 coming. We just want to see how much of a basket he's going to bring to take it away with him.
That particular GI had been too busy up front fighting to collect his pay heretofore. He came by to pick it up without a basket, and there were others.
Okay, Sergeant Reynolds reporting for pay, sir.
10, 20, 30, 40, 50. $50 even.
Thank you, sir.
Here's the Carl R. Williams reporting for pay, sir.
$98. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 95, 96, 97, 98.
And here's a soldier from Oklahoma with what must be the lowest pay in the Army.
Well, I only have $10 a month coming to me now. Most of it's going home, and first few months I fouled up on my pay. That is, they drew my allotment at home, and I drew it here also. So now I'm only getting the 10, which goes pretty well to the PX, the laundry, and developing films. I take a few pictures with my box camera then. My name is PFC Dallas Wilmoth of Hydro, Oklahoma.
With large-scale plans for troop rotation still to be put in operation, the Army has improvised a temporary system, and various companies' drawings are held, and the winners get a few days in Tokyo. Here at a Korean airport, NBC's Irving R. Levine talks with GIs coming back to war from peaceful Japan.
Hi, soldier. What's your name?
Sergeant Jack Lance, sir.
Where are you from?
Mansfield, Ohio.
How did you enjoy your visit to Japan?
It was great.
How does it feel to be back in Korea?
It's all right, I guess. I don't know.
Here are three more soldiers who just stepped off the C-54. Well, how does it feel to be back in Korea?
Don't feel so good. Feel a little lousy to be back in Korea.
It's nothing like Japan, that's for sure.
And one of the most popular diversions in Japan and Korea these days is listening to the Armed Forces Radio's so-called Fearless Follies, the brainchild of one Sergeant Fred Forgette. Now, this memorable program is GI humor at its best. We thought you might enjoy a sampling.
Tonight, we'd like you to relax to the sweetest music this side of Yokohama. But first, a brief word from our sponsor.
Do you know in what type of boots those men are marching? Why, the new Fearless combat boot.
Oh, Roman, don the Ginza in me Fearless combat boots. Roman, don the Ginza with me girlfriend, lovely Toots. With me boots shined up so bright, never loose or never tight. I'll tell you, man, they're very inexpensive.
Fearless combat boots with built-in knife and compass are available at your local supply room or neighborhood PX. This Fearless Follies broadcast has many sponsors, all imaginary, among them some Korean moneylenders.
But this time, I'd like to ask the president of the Fearless Bank of Korea to stand up and give the financial report on our branch bank over in Taejon. Sir, are the assets frozen and chosen? And if not, how much do we have, sir?
I've got sixpence to last me all my life. I've got tuppence to spend and tuppence to lend and tuppence to send home to my wife. All this brought relief from the tensions of war. But leaders in the administration were concerned this week with the fact that Americans here at home generally weren't concerned enough about the gravity of the world crisis. The president put it this way.
Every day our newspapers tell us about the fighting in Korea. Although we read about these sacrifices in our newspapers every day, we have a tendency to think of the defense effort only in selfish terms, in terms of avoiding personal inconvenience or making some personal gain. Our young men are offering their lives for us in the hills of Korea. And yet too many of us are chiefly concerned over whether or not we can buy a television set next week or make the profit we expect to make this year or how we can turn the situation to our own selfish advantage.
And at midweek, Speaker of the House Sam Rayburn, not usually given to alarm, told his colleagues that non-Chinese communist troops were massing in Manchuria and Korea. Said Speaker Rayburn,
"This winning of a little battle in Korea had better not lull the American people to sleep, because I think that we stand in the face of terrible danger and may be the beginning of World War III."
Yes, there were many to lament the fact that there seemed no real sense of peril across the country. Mobilization Chief Charles E. Wilson found his job a tough one in the present climate of opinion. He thought we'd need lots of controls, but he saw another weapon against inflation, too, consumer resistance.
I still believe that the law of supply and demand will maybe look to for the cure. For example, a manufacturer saw me within the last 48 hours. And he was telling me that his whole industry, as he knew it, which had been, guilty of raising prices far more than they had any right to, now they're paying the price for it. The public has just stopped buying, and the public just won't buy, and the natural laws go to work again.
One cheerful note in the mobilization picture, labor was ready to join the team once more. A very touchy matter this week was a plan to defer college students in the draft through the use of intelligence tests. This scheme would allow large numbers to complete their studies if they passed that test. Was it a tough exam? We asked Draft Director Hershey.
Well, yes, I don't think there's any question about being stiff. There's some question about whether 70, which will cut off 16 or 18% up above it and 80-some percent of it below, is selective enough or not. But one of the reasons that I went for the system was the fact that 70 was nothing immutable about it. We chose it for this year, but we could make it 80 or 85. In other words, we could fix it so only 2 or 3% could pass if manpower got tight enough.
But this idea of deferment for college on an IQ basis brought many objections from the press and public. Said the military editor of the New York Times, Hanson W. Baldwin,
"Some say that this means an oligarchy of brains. Obviously, the reason for this ruling is to maintain our college population, and not to make the mistake we did in the last war when we drafted indiscriminately. We need more scientists, engineers, and technicians. On the other hand, there are obvious disadvantages to such a system. It's unfair to those who can't go to college, and there are other requirements besides brains alone. You need character and leadership qualifications, and the services need men with brains also. So brains alone are not enough." And now back to Jim Fleming.
Among the students themselves, there was a variety of reaction. This from the University of California at Berkeley.
"I'm against the present selective service program of draft deferment for the so-called bright men for a year. And why should anyone be deferred anyway simply because they happen to be bright? I'd like to know by what rule they're going to determine brightness anyway. Say that a fellow's good in English or history, but all his life he's been lousy in math. He fails the math test, so he's out of school and into the army. Is that fair?"
That was the opinion in California. At the other end of the nation, in New York City, students were equally frank to express their feelings.
"I'm a college senior graduating in June. I intended to find a job after I graduated, but now, with the new presidential proclamation, I'm going to try to get into graduate school."
Another young man was elated at his new opportunity.
"I was so happy, I didn't know what to do, because first of all, I was worried whether I was going to be drafted this summer. I want to go to dental school, and I certainly haven't been going here knocking myself up for 3 years for nothing. I was very glad that he said it."
But other draft-age men who can't go to college were less enthusiastic about the president's idea.
"I'm a clerk in a downtown department store, and I don't think that the presidential edict is very fair to us. First of all, you've got to realize that I feel that I am being washed out of college and being taken into the army for no cause whatsoever, when other fellows who have the money and can go to and afford college can get in there, and I'm out."
There was lots of congressional opposition to this system of deferment. Everyone seemed to agree that the nation must have college-trained experts, but not many were agreed on the method of their selection. As Hanson Baldwin pointed out, the military needs brains, too. This was the week that the Senate endorsed four more divisions for Atlantic Pact forces in Europe, the week that General Eisenhower formally activated his command. America's Atlantic Pact representative in London, Charles Spofford, felt that real progress had been made.
12 nations have in these past months given evidence in a tangible way of their determination that this machinery shall be truly effective. Last Monday, General Eisenhower formally assumed command of his unified force, an army which has been brought into being not to prepare for a war, but to ensure our 12 nations against any threat of aggression, to maintain peace through strength.
Peace through strength. The final Senate vote on troops for Europe was 69-21, but the resolution called on the President to consult with Congress before sending any additional forces to the continent. Said Senator Lodge,
the resolution says that we are willing to send a limited number of American troops abroad on the understanding only that the nations of Europe put up a far larger number. The resolution sets up safeguards so that Congress will be constantly informed of what is happening and can thus exercise complete control by constitutional processes at any time that it wants to do so.
Senator Wary felt that many of his ideas had been incorporated in this final version.
The Senate's action on troops for Europe carries out the purposes of the resolution introduced by me last January the 8th, which resolution focused the attention of the Congress and the American people upon the great issues involved. While I am personally gratified, the important thing is the Senate has struck a blow for preservation of the principle of the Constitution that Congress, representing the people, is master of the military establishment and not the President.
This resolution had finally been passed 86 days after it was introduced. Administration stalwarts like Senator McMahon were a bit weary after all the debate.
I am not satisfied with some of the provisions in the resolution which would serve to tie the hands of the President of the United States in the quick execution of what may be necessary for the preservation of freedom in the world. But I don't suppose that in a legislative assembly, particularly in the United States Senate, you ever get everything you want. There's more unity than appears on the surface.
You're listening to Voices and Events, NBC's living record of history. These are the actual voices of the people who made the news, gathered by NBC correspondents all over the world. Again, the editor of Voices and Events, James Fleming. A few weeks ago, Harold Stassen stopped off in London, and NBC's Romney Wheeler put a question to him.
Mr. Stassen, what brings you to London?
Mr. Wheeler, I am in London for the purpose of inviting the Right Honorable Winston Churchill to deliver the bicentennial address at a great convocation in Convention Hall, Philadelphia, in May.
This week, Winston Churchill accepted the invitation to speak in Philadelphia on May 8th. Britain's wartime leader has twice chosen an American platform in the post-war years to bring to the world his analysis of the growing communist threat. It was in March 1946, with President Truman sitting alongside, that Winston Churchill coined a phrase that is now part of the language.
An iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia.
Then, 3 years later, another visit to America and another historic speech by Winston Churchill. This at MIT in March 1949.
It is certain that Europe would have been communized like Czechoslovakia and London under bombardment some time ago, but for the deterrent of the atomic bomb in the hands of the United States. War is not inevitable. Often something happens to turn or mitigate the course of events.
Much has happened since that appraisal. Soviet atomic power, a fighting war in the Orient. 4 weeks hence, we'll have Mr. Churchill's views on the current crisis. Out of the British government since the war, the former Prime Minister has been, in many ways, like a great actor without a vehicle. He's made every effort to recapture a position of power, only last week urged an immediate general election.
Trust the people. Go to the people. Let the people have their say. Let there be a general election where they can express their will. Where they can express their will through a parliament worthy of what is strongest and best in our race.
And just a few days ago, Labour's Prime Minister, Mr. Attlee, rose from a hospital bed to counter the Churchill charge.
He struck, as he generally does when not in office, a rather gloomy note. He concentrated on a demand for an immediate general election. But you will remember this was exactly what he demanded a year ago. He kept telling me then, as he does now, that we needed a united nation, and the way to get it was to have a general election. Well, we had one. He failed to win it. However much he tries to juggle with the figures in order to make out that Labour did not win, one thing at least is certain. He lost.
But history may have another rendezvous with Mr. Churchill. Meanwhile, the Conservative leader sounds his solemn warnings to a troubled world. There's no telling when Britain may have its next election, but we're pretty certain about our own. Autumn 1952 gets closer and closer. So let's join now with Quentin Reynolds to see how the prospective presidential candidates shape up. Quent, let's have your analysis.
Jim, the first thing any good political reporter does is to spot a trend. When all else fails, you can always spot a trend. Out in Chicago this week, they held an election. The Democrats have been in power there for 20 years. You know, the Windy City has a more colorful political life than most others. And to find some real color, NBC's Len O'Connor visited with the voters of Skid Row.
You're registered? How do they know you're registered?
Well, you register wherever you live. I just got a buck once. That was the last time I come over here.
You think a dollar is a fair price for a ballot?
Naturally, don't you think so?
Well, if you can get two, you're better off getting two, aren't you?
Yeah, if I can get it.
Well, that isn't the whole Chicago picture by any means. But the point is, Jim, that the Democrats held on to power. And Chicago is the key to Illinois, which has 29 electoral votes.
But meanwhile, Quint, the Republicans were winning in a lot of places, including Michigan.
True enough, Jim. The trends are where you spot them. But do you know what strikes me most about the presidential picture?
What's that?
Nobody wants to run.
Well, someone has to.
Well, take Senator Douglas, for example. He's mighty popular in the Democratic column. And do you know what he said to people who urged him to run?
The job is really an impossible job, and it calls for the brooding qualities of Lincoln, the philosophic depth of Jefferson, the sturdiness of Cleveland, the daring of Franklin D. Roosevelt, and the popular leadership qualities of Theodore Roosevelt. In addition, he must be a spiritual leader. He needs the patience of Job and must have the physique either of a Sandow, a Samson, or a Charles Atlas. Any man who wants to be president of the United States ought to have his head examined.
You see what I mean? Then there's Estes Kefauver. He's at a peak of popularity. But does the senator from Tennessee choose to run? He does not.
Nobody ever thought of me for president, and certainly I've never thought of it myself. I just want to be a United States senator. If I can't be that, I want to go back to Tennessee and be a country squire.
Well, we once had a country squire in the White House.
Could be. Now let's talk about Republicans. There is one GOP aspirant who hasn't given up the idea of 4 years in the White House. Congressman Rogers of Florida put a question to Harold Stassen this week.
The question is this, Governor. Would you tell us quite honestly whether or not your political ambitions are dead?
Whether or not what?
Whether your political ambitions are dead.
No, I'm not dead in any respect, I hope.
Quint, do you think Stassen has a chance?
Why, Jim, every red-blooded American boy has a chance to become president.
How about Tom Dewey?
We're back to the old story now. He doesn't want to be president either. Remember what he said last fall?
I am definitely and finally removed. I removed myself by a letter. That's about 18 months ago, and that is beyond consideration. If I should be reelected governor and have influence with the New York delegation, I would recommend to them that they support General Eisenhower for president if he would accept the draft.
Ah, Eisenhower.
Jim, that's what both the Democrats and the Republicans are saying to themselves. Ah, Eisenhower. But Ike, far from announcing presidential ambitions, hasn't even publicly announced what party he belongs to. That's the sort of thing that could upset the best-laid plans of the senator from Ohio. But Mr. Taft doesn't want to run either. At least, not very hard.
I'm certainly not a candidate for the nomination. I'm not going to run for president. I don't say that I wouldn't take the nomination if it were offered to me, but I shall make no campaign to get it.
And so we come to Harry S. Truman.
Well, the other day, Mr. Truman announced that he had made up his mind about 1952. But that's all he said. However, an Undersecretary of Labor, Michael Galvin, speaking with the apparent approval of the Democratic National Committee, said this.
The future of the Democratic Party is good. The outlook for 1952 is good. I am willing to predict here and now that Harry S. Truman will poll about 56% of the total two-party vote in 1952 and be reelected.
But the president is keeping his own counsel. My own guess is that he won't run unless he has to. Mr. Truman had a very rough time in 1948, and there comes a year when presidents long to be ex-presidents and live the less strenuous life. You'll remember, Jim, that the president had quite a time getting the nomination in 48. I remember that night in July. It was 2 a.m. before the convention was ready to receive him.
Now, sir, just 1 minute before 2 o'clock here in Philadelphia. Chairman Rayburn stands beside the president, and President Truman is adjusting the microphones himself to the level of which he wants. He holds up his left hand for silence. The crowd is seated. They're calling again for the photographers to sit down so they could see. And here is the speech by the President of the United States.
The photographers were asking that the mics be lowered.
I can't. I have to have them up where I can see. Senator Barkley and I'll win this election and make these Republicans like it. Don't you forget that.
Well, Quint, do you think he could do it again?
I don't think Mr. Truman wants to do it again. You see, Jim, as I said, no one wants to run. At least, that's what they're saying for publication. But the fact is, they're all waiting for the word. The word from Ike. And General Eisenhower is just too busy in Paris.
Well, thanks, Quint Reynolds, for this report on the presidential sweepstakes. And now we're going to close with a real horse race, yesterday's Grand National at Aintree in Scotland. And there's a parallel here because there were 36 starters and only one winner, the Grand National.
Now, they're just starting to line up. The first one in there was Prince Brownie, and Freebooters decide to go on the far side, and they're off! And my goodness!
Caesar's Wife up in front, now with Russian Hero, Nickel Coin, Dog Watch, and with that, it's over to you, Richard North.
Well, they're coming now. Oh, Caesar's Wife's gone. They're falling down like ninepins now. Russian Hero now is leading from Dog Watch and Gay Heather. And there are only about five horses apparently left in the race. This is fantastic.
Down goes Gay Heather, and now there are only three. There are only three with Nickel Coin in front of Royal Tan. Broomfield going up very well as they're coming to the fence after features. Nickel Coin over in front, and there goes Broomfield, and now there are two. This is history. This is sensational.
And now, as they're coming in now with 150 yards to go, Nickel Coin in front with Royal Tan, who made a mistake in that last fence, about a length behind him. And here comes from there. She is repeating the performance of Field Cottage. She's stretching out. She's about 10 lengths, 5 lengths clear, I think now. Nickel Coin, the winner.
You have been listening to Voices and Events, the sounds of history in our time. James Fleming is your editor and narrator. The week's living history with the sounds and voices in the news is made possible through new techniques of reporting and recording pioneered by the NBC Newsroom. This is Robert Warren inviting you to listen next week at this same hour when the NBC News and Special Events Department brings you the never-ending story that is the news on Voices and Events. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.